We're going to begin the stanza 10 of the Spiritual Canticle. And as I have been doing, I first read the verse of this beautiful poem that he wrote, and then give you an explanation, which I'm digesting, that he gave to kind of explain what he means by what we would call words that are difficult to understand unless an explanation is given. So now the person that he's talking about has already entered into a deeper relationship with God and has already experienced God's love. And there are different things now that are going to happen. So in the 10th verse, or stanza as he call it, first the introduction. At this point, this particular soul has known God's love in a very profound way. And it's like a person that is sick, extremely tired, no appetite or taste for food, in fact finds all food nauseating, finds everything to be an annoyance and a disturbance. But the sickness that this soul has is what we call the sickness of love of God. It's like people in love. You know, there is a sickness. They've got heart trouble. And there are three characteristics evident. And everything that happens to the soul or is offered to her, now St. John of the Cross speaks of the soul as feminine, because in our relationship with God, whether we are male or female, our spirit is bride to Jesus Christ, okay? So everything that is offered to the soul or that the soul has to deal with, there's a constant longing for the beloved, that's the Lord. Her heart is fixed on him. Now this applies to the duties that that are even the will of God, but require action and activity on her part. It could be anything, teaching, household duties, obligations of some profession in life, all that a mother has to do, raising a family, or a father, having a livelihood, working at it. And a second characteristic, a loss of taste for all things, like their taste for recreations that have changed. Well, let me precede that. It's like the change that is experienced by many people when they receive the what we call the baptism in the Holy Spirit, who find that their taste for recreations have changed, certain friendships, even for certain foods, and a number of things that they've done before that they find are inconsistent with where they're at now in their relationship with God. But now, it is more pronounced, and it extends to all things that are not the Lord. She will attend a public function, participate in them, and social affairs, but there is no taste for them. A third characteristic, as a result of the first two, this third characteristic becomes evident, namely, all these affairs become an annoyance for the soul, and all dealings with others are experienced as burdensome and trying. Now, our saint explains the reason for this reaction by saying that the soul in its will has tasted God's love and is so taken up with this love that it seeks this love and her beloved in everything that happens, and in all her tasks, without any selfish seeking of her own. Like Mary Magdalene, if you recall the story in the Gospel, seeking Jesus with ardent love, she's prepared to do anything to find him. And when she encounters the gardener, she's willing to carry the body of the Lord herself, if necessary. In the words, if you have taken him from me, tell me, and I will take him away. So the person described here has a similar yearning to find Jesus, and not finding him at once as she wishes, but feeling she has lost him, finds that all things become a torment for her, which sometimes reaches a great extreme. So it is understandable that such souls experience much suffering in affairs that require meeting and dealing with people, business affairs, because they see them as obstacles rather than helps to find the Lord. But we must understand this. This person has a delicate conscience, and they know that these affairs are often God's will, so they do not neglect them. They're very faithful to that. But it doesn't prevent them from having that feeling of annoyance, okay? Here, our saint uses the Song of Songs in Scripture, chapter 5, verses 6 to 7, for this purpose. The words are, I looked for him and did not find him, but they who go about the city found me and wounded me, and the guards of the walls took my mantle from me. He compares those who go about the city to what we would call the affairs of the world. Shopping, household chores, driving from one place to another, visiting doctors, going to different lectures of different kinds. And he says that for a soul searching for God, these things inflict many wounds of sorrow, pain, displeasure on it, because the soul not only does not find her beloved in them, but is also prevented from finding him by them. They're like distractions that draw us away from what we find so desirable to think of. Later on, when there is a true harmony between body and spirit after the purification that he will speak of, the soul can then find the Lord everywhere and does not experience this restless longing. The soul experiences a rebellion now at having to be subject to so many things that it finds seemingly drawn away from the beloved. Following the lines of the canticle, those who guard the wall of contemplation are the devils and worldly affairs. They destroy the peace and quiet of the loving contemplation that this soul is seeking. This is one of the strongest convictions persons drawn to the Lord in this way have. They want to leave the world and seek solitude anywhere, sometimes in the remotest parts of the world, like a mountaintop, a cave, a hermit dwelling in a deep forest. Just think what a hermitage in space might be like as one contemplates the beauties of the universe and the complete solitude and silence of space. That's quite a thought. Have your own capsule? Unable to leave the world, yet experiencing a thousand annoyances from all these things, and knowing that as long as she lives in this life without seeing God, she cannot free herself from the annoyances, even in a small degree, she turns to her beloved with this request, and this is the stanza now. Extinguish these miseries, since no one else can stamp them out, and may my eyes behold you, because you are their light, and I would open them to you alone. Now, since the beloved alone can put an end to her tormenting longings and pains, she pleads with him to put an end to them in the first line, extinguish these miseries. When her desire for the Lord goes unfulfilled, everything that is not conformed to what the soul or the will loves wearies, tires, annoys, displeases her. So she calls this weariness she suffers, namely to see God, miseries. She purposely uses the word extinguish because she's suffering from the fire of love, and only the possession of her beloved can extinguish these miseries by his presence and refresh her from the heat of this fire. Now, what you're going to learn here is there's a love of God that is so great that you've never heard it this way before. There's no love in human life like this. And there are very few saints that have described it as he has. The next line, since no one else can stamp them out, in an effort to persuade the beloved to grant her wish, the soul indicates that he alone can fulfill her desire and satisfy her. So he must be the one to extinguish these miseries. When God finds a soul that truly loves him alone, wants no consolation or satisfaction outside of him, then he's very ready to bring comfort and fulfillment to that soul. Since it is so detached that it possesses nothing that might keep her from the Lord, the beloved comes quite soon to visit her. Now note, we need to be careful here how we apply this knowledge in our personal spiritual life. to rigidly apply what is said here about seeking no comfort or satisfaction in anything outside of God could lead to disaster. For example, to make all one's food taste bitter, to seek no recreation for the body, or deny needed sleep, in no way to provide some body comforts that are as they are needed. This is not what is meant here. But what is meant is, this soul is not attached to what by nature brings comfort and consolation to a person, like sleep, food, drink, recreation when needed. Let us remember the words of St. Therese, the little flower. Her words are, I will offer him all my sufferings and all my enjoyments too in the spirit of love. Now that's perfect balance. And the next line, and may my eyes behold you. In other words, the soul is saying, I would like to see you face to face with the eyes of my soul. And then the following line, because you are their light. The expression used by lovers, you are the light of my eyes, remember that song, is given affectionate expression as the soul here applies them to her beloved. We might rephrase the above two lines in these words of our saint. Since my eyes have no other light, neither through nature or through love, than you, may my eyes behold you, because you are their light in every way. Many supernatural experiences have the impression of brilliant light as the soul becomes aware of the divine presence, or from those who have had a life-after-death experience, when they encountered a being surrounded by brilliant, blinding light. St. John, in his book of Revelations, chapter 21, 23, writes, the heavenly city has no need of the sun nor of the moon to shine in it, because the brightness of God illumines it, and the Lamb is the lamp thereof. And the final line, and I would open them, meaning my eyes, to you alone. Now, you remember a song that runs, I have eyes only for you. And the title of that is, Are the Stars Out Tonight? Are the stars out tonight? And how does the line go? Okay. Well, I've encouraged you. Wishing to persuade the beloved to reveal this light of her eyes, she indicates that she closes her eyes to everything else and keeps them open on God alone. She will be rewarded generously. On the other hand, one experiences spiritual darkness as the eyes of the will or desire are focused on something else outside of God. And now the 11th stanza. An introduction to that. The divine bridegroom cannot stand by for long just watching this soul suffering as it does here from love for him. Such sufferings touch him, as our saint says, in the apple of his eye. To show how quickly the beloved comes to the soul, our Carmelite master quotes Isaiah. Before they call, I will come to the soul. Before they call, I will hear. While they are yet with a word in their mouth, I will hear them. That's Isaiah 65:34. Our saint is evidently speaking of himself when he says that here the soul in question has received, quote, a certain spiritual feeling of God's presence. In other words, a presence that has fired up her prayers, created within her such a desire for him that she seeks him with more eagerness than someone else might seek money. For she has left herself and all other things for him. Along with this experience of his presence, this soul has received some profound glimpses of the Lord's divinity and beauty. It is this knowledge that has greatly increased the fire of her love and desire to see him. This is the Lord's way of making some souls more fervent as he prepares them for even greater favors. Through the Holy Spirit, the soul finds itself stirred up with fiery longings that bring insight into God's excellence. And this is done like a man might throw water into a fiery forge to stir up and intensify the fire. If you've ever been in a blacksmith shop or somewhere where they're forming steel, and that's something that they do. So having had some glimpses of God as a supreme good and beauty, and dying with a desire to see him, the soul says, "Reveal your presence, and may the vision of your beauty be my death. For the sickness of love is not cured except by your very presence and image." Now the sickness of love becomes so unbearable that now the soul asks her beloved to reveal his beauty and divine being and take her out of this mortal body in death, because she cannot otherwise see and enjoy him as she wants. So she reveals the deep yearning of her heart to him and is unable to find any other cure in anything else except the blessed and glorious vision of God in his divine essence as he is. So she says, "Reveal your presence." We should know that there are three presences of God. First, his presence by his very being, his essence. In this kind of presence, God gives all creatures their life and being. If it were absent, creatures would vanish into nothingness. Even the stone is kept as a stone by God's very existence and essence. So this presence is never wanting in creatures, and also for the soul here. His presence by grace is the second kind. Here God dwells in the soul and is pleased and satisfied with it. This kind of presence comes with baptism, or whenever one has lost this kind of presence through mortal sin and is pardoned in the sacrament of reconciliation and is restored. A third presence is his presence by spiritual affection. This kind of presence is usually granted to devout souls in many ways, to refresh, delight, fill them with joy. But even in these kinds of spiritual presence, God remains hidden, and the soul does not see him as he is, and cannot do so in this mortal life and live. What this particular person is asking is that the beloved reveal his hidden presence so she may be able to see him in his divine being and beauty. She especially asks him to bestow on her the experience of a certain affective, loving presence, which is so sublime that she feels there is an immense hidden being that grants her some glimpses of God's divine beauty. The longing is so great that the soul, as it were, faints with longing to be submerged in the supreme good she feels is present to her. And while she knows it is hidden, she still enjoys a notable experience of the great good and delight that's contained there. The growing attraction the soul experiences for God can now be compared to the force of gravity, as a falling object seeks its center of gravity and draws it closer to the earth as it falls out of the air. Our Carmelite master attributes this kind of experience to Moses on Mount Sinai as he stood in God's presence and apparently had a glimpse of God's divinity. And then Moses said, "If I have found favor in your presence, show me your face, that I may know you and find before your eyes the grace which I desire fulfilled." Exodus chapter 33, 12, 13. In other words, he's saying to reach the perfect love of God's glory. That's what he means. But God said to Moses, "You shall not be able to see my face, for no man shall see me and live." Now the soul knows the truth of these words of God by experience. For when God reveals his presence to the soul even vaguely, the soul faints and is prepared for the kind of reply that God gave Moses. And so it says in the next line, and may the vision of your beauty be my death. Put in other words, we can say of this soul, since I would die at the sight of your beauty, with a great delight I would experience, may the vision of your beauty be my death. According to our St. John of the Cross, two visions bring death to man. First, the sight of what he calls the basilisk. Now that's a fabled reptile of the African desert, whose breath and appearance were said to be fatal. Now this was only an imaginary creature, believed to actually exist at the time of St. John of the Cross. So he accepted that and only used it as an example. The second is the vision of God. The saint goes on to say that if the soul had only a slight glimpse of the height and beauty of God, she would be happy to experience 1,000 very bitter deaths, if only for a moment she could see him, and then suffer just as many to see him for another moment. Now, no one can understand this unless they've experienced it. John of the Cross defends the soul's desire to see God, even if it be dying, but it does not desire death itself. He refers to St. Paul's words to the Corinthians, 2 Corinthians 5:4. We do not wish to be unclothed, but we desire to be clothed over, that that which is mortal may be absorbed in life. It's like saying, we do not want to be deprived of the body, but to be covered with glory. And even Paul, knowing that this cannot be done simultaneously, says to the Philippians that he wants to be freed and to be with Christ. Now, why does this soul want to die at the sight of God? Since the coming of Jesus, who redeemed us, opened up heaven to all the dying who are prepared, those who die in God's friendship and grace are separated from the body and can't see God. So the desire to live but a short while and then to die in order to see God is more perfect. And our saint adds another reason. When a soul loves the beloved truly, it receives everything from him, whether it be joyful and consoling or a source of trial and suffering and even chastisement, with the same calm disposition, because they are all his wish. So in the words of St. John the Evangelist, perfect charity casts out all fear. First Epistle of John 4:18. For such a soul, death cannot be bitter, because in its love it sees only sweetness and delight at the thought of death. There is no sadness or painful anxiety or a heavy burden, for death will be the end of all her sorrows and torments and the beginning of every happiness for her. So she longs for the day and the hour of her death, for it will announce her betrothal and marriage. Here we might remember what we recall the saying of St. Teresa Little Flower about death and her longing to be with the Lord, and how love burned in her heart to the point that she wanted to die of love, and how God actually fulfilled her request in her last moments. For the soul at this stage of the journey in love, death will not deprive her of the love she possesses, but will rather bring that love to complete fulfillment. This ought to be the Christian view of death, as one nears the end of life's journey and is prepared for that great moment. There is the natural fear of death that may bring anxious moments to the dying person, but if the soul is prepared, the grace of God will be there to free it from such fears. How true are the words of David when applied to good, holy, and devout souls at the moment of death, namely, precious in the eyes of the Lord is the death of the saints. At Psalm 33:22. We can say that a soul who loves God lives more in the next life than in this life, because she lives where she loves more than where she gives life. And the next line, for the sickness of love is not cured except by your very presence and image. This sickness of love is quite different from other sicknesses, and its medicine is also different. So in natural sickness, one contrary is cured by another contrary. For example, a burning heat is lowered by cold packs. Heat is lowered by what is cold. But in the case of love sickness, only the object of love, the presence of the beloved, is the cure and remedy. So the good health of the soul is the love of God. And if it has a very little of that love, it may be alive, but quite weak and infirm. As this love increases, the soul becomes healthier. And when love is perfect, the soul will have perfect health. In this life, love will never reach that kind of perfection until there is a transformation. The lovers are so alike that one is transfigured in the other. So the image of Jesus Christ, the bridegroom, is sketched in the soul by baptism and is more and more completed by grace, but cannot ever be complete in this life. So the soul wants the sketch to be completed. Although this sickness of love is still imperfect, one who feels this kind of sickness shows that they have some love because they are aware of what they need and are missing by what they have. But if one does not have this sickness in any degree, he either has no love or is perfect in love. At some time or other, every soul in the state of grace experiences a longing for heaven and perfect fulfillment of all this, of all its desires. This is something of the kind of love we're talking about. The next stanza, 12. As this particular person grows in love, she feels like a stone that gathers speed as it nears its center of gravity. So it feels like rushing toward God. Or to use another comparison, she feels like soft wax on which an impression is being made, but the impression is not quite completed. To put it another way, she feels like a canvas stretched on an easel on which a sketch or first drawing has been made and is now calling upon the divine artist to complete the sketch and the image. She now has a faith that is so enlightened that she has some view of who God really is. Not knowing where to turn or what to do, the soul now turns to this very faith, which in a hidden way contains the image and beauty of her beloved. From this faith, she knows that she has received the sketches and tokens of the Lord's love. So she now speaks to this faith in these words of the 12th stanza. O spring like crystal, if only your silvered over face, you would suddenly form the eyes I have desired, which I bear sketched deep within my heart. Now you couldn't possibly ever understand that verse alone. But it is poetry like you've never heard. Some of the great Spanish poets today say when they read his verses in the Spanish, he said it makes their hair stand up straight. But when you hear his explanation, you say, that has got to be the way it is. So no creature can be a remedy for the need of this particular soul. So she turns to faith as the one means that gives her most light about her beloved, and as the way to union with him. According to our Carmelite master, there is no other means by which one reaches true union and spiritual engagement with God. And he refers to the prophet Osee, chapter 2:20, in the words, I will espouse you to me in faith, unquote. So the bride soul, burning with love, says, O faith of Christ, my spouse, would that you might show me clearly now the truths of my beloved, which you have infused in my soul, and which are covered with obscurity and darkness. Would that you would show these truths to me suddenly, clearly, and perfectly, changing this hasty knowledge in a manifestation of glory. Keep in mind that the knowledge that we have through faith is not clear, but dark, obscure, or hazy. It does not give us all the details, but the general sketch. It's like a veil that stands between the truths of God and our mind, and the soul here asks that this veil of faith be drawn away. So the first line reads, O spring-like crystal. Faith is compared to a crystal, and for two reasons. First, because faith is concerned with Christ the Spouse. Second, because faith has the characteristics of crystal, namely, it is pure in its truths, strong and clear, free of errors and human ideas. Faith is called a spring, because like a spring, from faith, the waters of all spiritual blessings come to the soul. Here, St. John of the Cross refers to the Lord's words to the Samaritan woman at the well, to faith, when John says, Jesus called faith a spring by saying that whoever believed in him, he would make a fountain of water spring up within him, whose waters would leap up into everlasting life. John 4:14. The water here, our saint says, is the Holy Spirit, who would be received by all who believed. The next line, if only on your silvered over face. On these words, the Carmelite master compares faith to silver in the outer garment of the words it gives us and uses to present the mysteries of God. But the truths themselves and the substance of what faith contains is compared to gold. In the next life of eternal happiness, we will see clearly and enjoy freely the very substance of the truths we now in faith believe and are, as it were, covered over with a silver of faith. For example, belief in one God, but three persons. These are the words presented by faith, covered over by the reality of what they contain, but the reality of what they contain is hidden. How can you have three in one? Three persons, one God. We don't know. So that reality is hidden, and this is the goal. What these words really mean will only be known in the next life fully. So faith gives us God truly, and the reality of his infinite being, but under cover of the silver of faith. It is something like being given a gift of a gold vase covered over with silver. Still, it would be a gold vase, right? But silver plated. The next line reads, you would suddenly form the eyes I have desired. In these words, the eyes mean the divine truths and the rays of God's divinity. Now, our faith presents these truths to us covered over by the definition of faith as we have them now in the Apostles' Creed, or the Nicene Creed that we recite on Sunday. So it's like saying, oh, if only the truths hidden in your statements of faith, which you teach me in a dark, obscure way, if only you would give me these truths completely, clearly, and free of the veil that covers them. Give them to me now. She calls these truths eyes because of the great awareness she has of the presence of the Beloved. She now has an abiding sense or an awareness that the Beloved is always looking at her. It's not our conscious awareness of God. It's like my awareness that you're looking at me now. Notice that? That's different than your awareness of somebody sitting beside you. See, there are two different kinds of awareness. So she continues, I should complete a note I've added. Many souls speak of this. They are aware of God looking at them, not the same as our awareness of God, like I just illustrated, as I'm aware of you being aware of me. And oftentimes that makes people self-conscious. The next line, in other words, that you have, you would suddenly form the eyes of desire, which I dare sketch deep within my heart. By sketch, she means impressed or imprinted deep in her soul, the intellect and will. The truths of faith are infused by faith into our intellect, but the knowledge of these truths is far from perfect. So she uses the word sketched, just as a sketch is only an outline, not the perfect picture. So knowledge through faith is not perfect knowledge. But when the truths infused into us by faith become clearly visible, they will be like a perfect finished painting in the soul. St. Paul in 1 Corinthians 13:10 speaks of this when he says, "Our knowledge is imperfect. When the perfect knowledge comes, the imperfect will pass away. Now we see indistinctly as in a mirror. Then we shall see face to face. My knowledge is imperfect now. Then I shall know even as I am known." This means that the knowledge of faith will come to an end when the clear vision of God and the mysteries of faith come to the soul. Now, in addition to a sketch of faith, which is drawn in the intellect of the soul, our saint speaks of another sketch being drawn in the will of the lover, called the sketch of love. He puts it very beautifully in these words, "When there is union of love, the image of the beloved is so sketched in the will and drawn so intimately and vividly that it is true to say that the beloved lives in the lover and the lover lives in the beloved. Love makes the lover like the beloved. When God is the beloved here, what takes place is beyond language to express the reality." So our saint is speaking of a much later union and transformation that will take place, but in that union and transformation of love, the soul and the beloved each gives possession of self to the other, and each leaves and exchanges self for the other. If this is so, then we can say in our saint's words, each one lives in the other and is the other, and both are one in the transformation of love. Those are his words. They are mysterious. They've never been contradicted by the church. Each one lives in the other, the soul in God, and each is the other. He makes it clear that the soul is not God, and both are one in the transformation of love. Here the saint refers to those famous words of Paul about himself, "I live, now not I, but Christ lives in me," Galatians 2:20. Paul means that even though he had life, it was not his life, because he was transformed in Christ, and this life in him was more divine than human. So he can say, Christ lives in him and not Paul. In the likeness that took place in Paul with Christ in the transformation, Paul's life and Christ's life were one life through a union of love. This kind of transformation into God's life will be perfectly accomplished in heaven in all those who come to merit eternal happiness. So if you and I don't have it now in this life, God willing, when we get to heaven, all this will take place. That's another reason why you should know it. They will truly live God's life and not their own. So they will be able to say then, we live, now not we, but God lives in us. So we can say with our saint, as he says here, so we can see what our saint says here is destined to happen to all of us, if not now, at least in the next life, as part of eternal happiness. Even if a soul reaches the highest union in love with the Lord in this life, called the spiritual marriage, this life can still be called a sketch of love when compared to the perfect image that will be imprinted on the soul in eternal life and happiness when it is transformed in glory. At this stage, our saint seems to be describing his own experience, and he says that it is indescribable. That is why he chose words that are poetic. Our language no longer fits the experience. But the soul can experience it. But there are no words to describe it. It's beyond human language. It seems that this particular soul that is body and spirit experienced such a dryness created through thirst for the living God that it cannot be put into words. And our Carmelite refers to the words of David, Psalm 41, 2-3, as the heart, the deer, longs for the font of waters, so does my soul long for you, my God. My soul is thirsted for God, the living font. When shall I see and appear before the face of God? It is a thirst that so exhausts the spirit that the soul would consider all the troubles and difficulties of this life, the hostility of the demons, and their afflictions as nothing, if she had to pass through them in order to plunge herself into the depths of divine love, as into refreshing waters. Here our saint refers to the Song of Songs. Love is as strong as death, and as jealousy as hard as hell. That's Song of Songs, chapter 8, verse 6. The ardent longing and pain the soul experiences incredible when she sees that she is quite near to enjoying the possession of her beloved, and yet does not have it. The pain and torment of frustration are a constant presence to this particular soul, and increase the more the soul comes near to it and seems about to grant it the longed-for union in love with him. Now that's love like you've never heard it described before. There's human love is something like that, but it's pale by comparison. Why? Because human love is just a small fraction of the infinite love that is God. And this soul is dealing with infinite love. And it's just overwhelming. And it's great, right? That's the kind of love that just made the saints, they just were out of themselves. That made St. Mary Magdalene, the Pazzi, the Carmelite saint in Florence, when she was hit at different times with this love, she'd run through the convent and say, "Love the Lord, love the Lord, love the Lord." And the sisters were wise enough to know that she was authentic. But she was so inspired and just out of herself and wondered that anybody could love anything else. Well, I forgot to tell you, you should have put on your spacesuits. We're in the rarefied atmosphere. Any questions? Like a question would be, what did he say? What am I saying these last 45 minutes? Yes.
I was just wondering, most of the saints are single, maybe the priests or nuns. Is this kind of love possible to attain such heights like this when you're married?
You just brought that question up at the right time. I have a book on the table. Do we have it on the table, or who has it now? Doris, would you bring it up here? This is a book that was just printed by Alpha House, and the title of it is Conchita. She is a very profound mystic, a mother of 9 children, lived a very happy married life, a healthy sexual life, and had a full family life, and all the troubles of raising a family, and all the social affairs that went with it, and the tragedies, and so forth. And she attained the highest sanctity. There's your answer. It's for everybody. And we do have other saints who were canonized, who were married, and achieved the highest union with God. And hopefully we will have two married people together beatified soon, the parents of the little flower. They had nine children, and the little flower is the last of them. Now just think, if they were troubled by birth control, you know, and had three children, where would St. Therese be today? He was in the seminary and she was in the convent. Yes.
And in the end, they had three children.
They were nine children.
No, I mean, that went into the convent.
Oh, no. All the sisters went into the convent. Yes. Yes, all of them.
So their wish was fulfilled in their children.
We must know, though, that three died young. Yes, I think three. Any other question?
Father,